3 at 7 a.m. Madam Clerk, would you please call the roll?
Ms. Sprinkle.
I'm here.
Ms. Tidwell.
Here.
Mr. Ringstaff.
Here.
Ms. Rogers.
Here.
Mr. Marnie.
I'm here.
Mayor Prus.
Here.
Mr. Cleworth.
Here.
Thank you. We are going to switch places with items 2 and 3. We're going to do the 2023 City Abatement Projects and City Abatement Code Discussion. We have Mr. Cluton here for questions, and I believe, Ms. Sprinkle, you brought this in.
It's turn to talk. My turn? Okay. I just know that we are in the midst of melting, and I am seeing more and more of the reasons that I want to talk about this becoming evident, and I am anxious to hear from Clem about what we're going to try to accomplish with this list of abatements. But more importantly, I'd like to see, and we can talk about it later maybe, but I just want to see what more the city can do to push these types of things along faster, because I've seen some of these things on this list for years, and I just look forward to Clem's report, and then we can maybe talk about a way to work with this.
Mr. Clinton, do you want to go over your list there of the 11 or 12 different properties and how they make your list and what your plans are for the summer?
Sure. Just a brief information. Last year we demolished, I think, 8 properties in the city limits. This year we have this list here that's and certainly we can add to the list if warranted at some time, or as projects come up, we will certainly add to them. The first one here is 649 11th Avenue. It's right to the south of us here, an old structure that's been there for 1960s or something or other. There was vagrants in there last year. I talked to the neighbor. I posted the building, talked to the neighbor. They were interested in buying it. So they've been working with the owner that lives in California, an elderly gentleman that's 80-some years old. They put money down on the property, and now there's a title problem. And, Mr. Prus, you probably have run into this in the past. So now the next-door neighbor is going to pull out. He says, I want my money back. The 80-year-old guy, he doesn't want to deal with him anymore, apparently. So that one there, I was hoping that the neighbor would knock it down and everything would be fine, but we probably will have to remove that building this year. The 431 Gaffney, that's the old Coin King. The owner of that had insurance. The insurance company sent 3 or 4 people up to review the property. They wouldn't pay him the adequate money, so thankfully he's going to go ahead and put a roof on it and use the building for some other purposes. So that one there should be resolved this year. 113 Second Avenue, that's an old house over by the river. We will get to that one this year. 113 Second?
Yeah. Who says that? Do you know the owner is?
It was just recently sold to another gentleman, so there's really no name there. 2628 Mercer Street, that was a property that the vagrants were in 2 years ago. I talked to the sister, the owner of the property, and I said, you've got to secure the building and get the people out. Well, then there was a fire last fall, so that one there is boarded up. And again, elderly lady, that her property, she doesn't have the money to remove it. She's requested that the city go ahead and knock it down and probably not charge her for that, because she doesn't have the funds. So I haven't talked to Mayor yet on that one there, but that one might be one that we would knock down and maybe put a lien on the property or something this year. So 737 7th, another house right over here to the north of us. A couple owns the property, and it burnt last spring, I think. We inspected the property and said that it was totally damaged, and the only resolve would be to demolish it, or, you know, if you want to revive it, then you need to get a structural engineer to go ahead and review it and give us plans to bring that back up. Now, again, there's the insurance company. They flew a person up here, and they said, we're only going to give you this so much money. So apparently not enough to for the demolition price. So this owner that was last fall, and I've been dealing with him this winter, this spring now, he still hasn't got it resolved. So I'll sit down with him and see which way we're going to work on that project. The 109 Fifth, still, the water's disconnected. I checked yesterday. They would have to dig up the street in order to turn it back on. But the new owner states that he's working to get that water turned back on after he pays the water bill that's been accumulating for a couple years.
Did he give any dates on when that'll be done?
The water turned back
on. When he'd have the water bill paid? And
No, he did not. But in the letter I sent him, I said that building's got to be secured and that property's got to be cleaned up, the yard and everything. And he said, I will be doing that. I said, how much time do you need? He said, well, I gave him till August 1st.
So you gave him a specific date.
Okay. A cleanup date. But now the water issue is, it's up to him.
If water's disconnected, basically that's an abatable house.
Well, it's if it's secured, water, and the building sits there, it's not an abatable house at
okay.
this time.
Okay.
That structure, if you drive by it, it's a nice log house that was we have a permit that we issued for a foundation in 1980, I think, somewhere in there, for a new concrete foundation. So it's, and when you go by and look at it, the building's straight, looks great. So we're going to see which way that one shakes out this summer here.
Okay.
Let's see, 719 Front. Okay, on Front Street last year, 2 years ago, 530 Front Street, that was a problem building. We finally got that knocked down. Well, if you drive to the east a little farther, there's some other structures there on the property and vehicles. And again, the owners are in out of state. So it's I'm going to have to work on both of those to send letters and get that ball rolling as far as to get that property cleaned up. The last two are 305 Kellum. That was a recent fire a month ago. I will be sending the letter to them regarding what their plan is. They're fairly small structures, so I think they would probably, hopefully, they'll be demolishing the building themselves. And that's the same with 311 Bonnyfield. Small structure, which we should be able to get resolved this summer. So that's all I have listed. It is quite a list, but you have any questions?
You had a couple, Ms. Rogers?
Well, this is a question for all of us, I think. Margarita, and in your office, too, with grant applications, but, you know, given the fact that most of the central comments that you bring to us about these properties are that there's an elderly person involved who can't deal with this, and that we can't just run roughshod over the circumstance. It's difficult, yes, but the more humane way has been how you've been handling this. Is it, I don't know what kind of grant funds might be available, but there's got to be something. I know there's things that have to do if you have preschool or kindergarten or whatnot. There's also things that are very age-related and elderly. And if we were to even begin our own set aside that people could contribute to in order to assist an older person with their difficulties, I know I'd be willing to donate to something like that. And But it's just a big, long-shot idea about how we get to the point of dealing with the persons who are really not able to deal with what we need to comply. So.
Yeah. I don't know of any, Grant. Go ahead.
I think you will have a difficult time finding a grant that would assist for personal property. HUD has grants that come to mind, but then once you do something with the property using HUD funds, it has to be, you know, kind of a public purpose. But that doesn't mean that there might be some private foundations that mm-hmm. might be able to assist yeah. with something like that.
Well, I think I'll keep asking, and I think it does have to do with public purpose. So there's that straw in there. Also, I think there's probably even local Alaska money that might be available for it. And some of the new committees I'm serving on, I'm going to ask some more questions too. Mike, I'll be asking you about that.
Ms. Sprinkle.
Clem, do you see a difference in out-of-town owners versus elderly?
Is there a difference?
Yeah.
Just out of town is hard to make contact with them back and forth. But, I mean, once we have a list, we start contacting the people. They post the building, the letter sent. We give them 30 days to respond to the appeal form. They have a right to appeal to our code review commission. After that, I assume the code review would say, no, it's time to demolish the building. So then the only other resolve would be take it to the state higher court. Anyway, we have never gone that far, but no, it's not out of town. It's just there's an example right over here on 8th Avenue garage last year. I went to the finance department to get the contact information to call. And here's a lady in Wasilla, 80 years old. She doesn't have any friends up here anymore. She doesn't know who to contact. So I talked her through it, and she found someone that go ahead and took about 3 weeks to knock their little shed down. And, you know, and so it worked out great. But in her case, that was a big issue because she was real affected by the letter, you know. So she thought that she had something there that was worth keeping. So it's, you know, we just deal with the people that are out of town, like this one on 11th Avenue, the first one. He's got better things to do, I guess. So I was hoping the neighbor would buy it so that he could do it, but chances are we'll put it out to bid probably, and we'll put a lien on the property, which will lose money, but that's part of the abatement funds. So I've got one other thing, Mayor. I think I skipped to on my list here. 124 Second Avenue, the old Creamery building.
Yeah.
Okay, so we all know about that one there. It used to be a drug place for people to hang out. Jeff in Public Works about 5 years ago, we cleaned it up. And now when you drive by, you still have the structure there, but the yard is clean. Inside, the building is clean. I think I've told you this before. The owner used to be a city engineer. He's pretty hard to deal with.
All city engineers are hard to deal with.
Yeah. but the structure, the roof caved in about 15 years ago or so. And he did not want to tear down the exterior walls. He thought those were great, maybe to rebuild for it. So Steve Shuttleworth required him to go ahead and get an engineer to secure those concrete walls. And Ken Ryberg, the other city engineer, he came up with the plan, and they put the posts in to hold the walls up, and that's where it sits today. So you know, our previous attorney, you know, we weren't going to try to force him to knock it down, because the worst thing to me would be we tear it down and they come back and say, no, you owe us some money. You tore down a good structure. The city pays. So that's why that's sitting there to this day. The 23-19 record, that's a small structure. We should be able to get that cleaned up. Yeah.
Mr. Okay. Marnie.
Clem, I know your department's understaffed. Would this pay for itself if we had a full-time officer that did nothing but abatements?
Well, it certainly isn't going to pay for itself. Because
with the loss, yeah.
The loss is $30,000-$40,000 to get a contractor in there to demolish a building.
So do you have time to maintain this?
Well, it's a list that's revolving. Yes, we are understaffed. We're missing a structural building inspector that we can't get filled. And we just got our secretary administrative assistant back. She was on maternity leave or babysitting her young child. And she worked from home, helped us with the permits issuing. But we only had three people in the office, and we had to have one person there to issue the permits. So we made it through. If we could get someone to come aboard on that building inspector job, that'd be great. I think to hire someone, it would be they'd be able to do other things besides the list. I mean, when you send the list, you send the letter, you got 30 to 45 days for them to respond. So you're moved to the next one. I think in-house, with a list like this, we can handle it.
And Mr. Ringstead, then Ms. Sprinkle.
So it seems to me most of these are probably excess of 50 years old, and a lot of old-time owners that have probably owned them since forever, and at a point in life they don't know and don't care, one or the other, maybe both. We still have a bunch more of these. I mean, is this something where this is going to continue to happen like this for the next 20 years, would be my guess. A bunch of these old structures in the downtown area. Is that?
Yeah, I would say.
We kind of got to look at this, not just today, but longer term.
Yeah, I would say hopefully not 20 years, but I would say 10 years. 10. If you keep getting 10 or so a year.
Ms. Sprinkle?
Oh, I just wanted to share with you a list of the properties that I've made within the river and airport and Cowles and Steese.
Could you email that list to the city clerk so she could distribute it to us, please?
Sure. So, and this is not anything about Clem. I just think that we as a city have to do better about these people who maybe they don't want to deal with it anymore. Maybe they do need help as elderly folks. But this doesn't give anybody a right to be a bad property owner. And I'm really frustrated to think I care about my house, I care about my neighbor. And if the property gets driven down, or more importantly, the tax revenues are ridiculous. If you take the creamery, I think it's tax revenue or to the borough, it's like $2,500 a month or year. The apartment building right next to it, which is I think the same size lot maybe, brings in $12,000 to $13,000 a year for property. The basic math of loss of income, it would help pay for a lot of things we're all looking for. So I think that not only is this a blight to our city, I think it is an economic deficiency that I'd like to see taken care of. And starting with this list is great.
Margarita, what was the amount of the budget that we put in for home abatement? Was it $250,000 or $200,000?
It was $225,000, but $25,000 was set aside for homeless camp.
Okay. And we increased that from $50,000 a year before?
It used to be set at $100,000, and this year we increased it to really $200,000 with $25,000 going to homeless camps.
So one way or another, we're trying to address it. I would say that no matter what, you're always going to have homes like this, so please get that list to me, city clerk, so we can take a look at it. Also, at the same time, Clem, we talked about the two properties on Hamilton. One is being hopefully rectified by the owner this summer, and the other one's the Irene Sherman's home. Have we looked at that one at all?
If I think that one there is 730 Front Street.
Yeah. Is that Irene Sherman's place there?
Yeah.
Okay. I always looked at it as Hamilton, so sorry.
Yeah. Yes. So on that one there, Irene Sherman owned it, lived there. There was a fire. So I'm dealing with the owners now, and it was another elderly lady that that really couldn't even communicate. She was, but she had her relative working. I worked with him. I said, okay, he wanted to keep that structure because it was an old log structure. He thought that, and if you drive by it, it's a log cabin that's fairly old. He thought that he wanted to save that for his family and stuff. So I said, you've got to keep it secured. But since then, a motorhome's been parked by it now. So that one there, I guess, I felt, some compassion. But at this point, we'll probably have to.
One thing I want everyone to be cognizant of is every property is different, every set of circumstances. And Clem's looking at every set of circumstances that comes in. Mm-hmm. I looked at the one on the old Coin King. Know the owner, know what happened. And the last thing you want is the city to have that property because of the ground contamination. The last thing you want. So everyone is a little bit different. Yes, Ms. Sprinkle.
Oh, a lot of this makes me the reason this matters to me is that we don't have a lot of housing downtown.
No, we don't. Yeah.
So if we were to deal with some of these properties, either to eliminate the blight or to rehab some of them, we could bring some housing back to the downtown space. So, this is not coming from a place of I hate old buildings. I just think we're lacking housing. This would be a place to start. And, I don't know if it takes a committee, a task force or something. I'd love to see us be able to noodle through some ideas, carrot and stick, I don't know what it is. For someone to just say, somebody's an older person who can't handle it anymore, that does not make the responsibility go away.
Actually, what it takes is a person like yourself with a list.
Yeah.
Going to take a look at it, giving it to Clem, and I would expect it's about a 2 to 3 year process of once he takes a look at it to get it knocked down, to tell you the truth.
In here we've got the creamery. There's no law in the book that says that can't be there for another 40 years.
Next time I see Steve Shuttleworth, boy, am I going to give him a good what for talking to about that boneheaded
move. It's insane. It's so irresponsible.
Yeah. You'll get a new owner in a couple of years.
Yeah. Ms. Rogers.
Well, I think there's also another component of being able to deal with the circumstances of some of the older housing downtown. And Sue is a prime example of persons who purchased something old downtown and has created a wonderful home for herself there. And we need to encourage our young people to reside downtown. And I'm not seeing that because I'm not hearing that. I'm that 80-year-old person you're talking about over here. I have all of those connections with people in this town. And I don't know very many Sues who have a house downtown. People are looking for a place outside of town still to this day.
Yeah. And hey, there's a couple townies here. Be careful what you say.
That's true. I'm that way too. But the thing is I'm not hearing it in a sufficient amount where it's a resurgence of downtown. And, I very seldom ever mention my personal circumstances of dollars when I'm in this seat here. And this first time I've mentioned McCafferty's from this microphone, but I will. We opened that place in the year 2000. It's almost 23 years now. Downtown at the time the Downtown Association and all the committees, and everybody was heralding the resurgence of downtown, and it was just on, you know, the brink of going up. Jerry can tell you these things, too, of having been down there all those years. And I still have friends who I went to kindergarten with in this town, and can they consider themselves rah-rah Fairbanks people? And every once in a while, I've only got two persons who said it this particular way, but one person did duplicate what the other said at another time, is, June, I've been meaning to come down there and see you guys. Excuse me? It's been over 20 years, and you're meaning to go downtown to do something? We have a complacency in our town that we refuse to acknowledge. Everybody gets on a plane and goes to Hawaii or Palm Springs or Arizona or whatever, and we all know that. We know a certain time of year when they do it. There's a certain category of activity that everyone here buys into, and it's not in downtown Fairbanks. And until we start acknowledging that and trying to deal with why people are not becoming a part of it. Sue is a pioneer here, the work that she does in downtown. And she voices it, she lives it, she breathes it and everything else. But she needs some people to follow her. You need a louder drumbeat or something. That's why I'm saying this.
Wow.
So,
I love my town. I just want to see it look better.
Mr. Clayworth.
109 Fifth Avenue is the house next to the cemetery, right?
Yes.
Okay. The water is still disconnected. I hear from residents that people are still going in and out of that house. Is that what you all hear, too?
It's true.
Normally, when the water is disconnected, they need to board it up so that people cannot get in there. But obviously, the owners are allowing people to get in there. We had the same problem with the house on Stacia Street years ago, and we had Public Works board it up. And for about a week, well, actually about a month, we ran a patrol car next by it every night to see if any activity was going on. If there was activity going on, and we found out that there was, we went after it on that house. On the handout that we have here on the legal footing that we have, under section 403.2, it mentions the safety of the general public. And the safety of the public in that area has been greatly compromised for a long time. I just wonder at what point we just keep allowing that to happen. I mean, I think we could be a lot more proactive on that property. This is my opinion.
That property changed hands a little while ago. We had a nice little meeting on that property with Ms. Sprinkle and the other owner across the street. And we have video cameras on it from the neighbor across the street. We've given them a specific time frame to clean up the yard. I don't see it happening, to tell you the truth. I just don't. It's been that way for a number of years. So my thought is on August 2nd, we go in, clean it up, clean it out, board it up, put a lien on the property, and park a patrol car in the parking lot there.
I think it'd be nice if we just chronicle the times in which that house is broke into.
Oh,
yeah. Cool.
And you have a first-hand seat.
Well, broke. I'm sorry, when you say break in, it's
allowed
not
in.
Secure now, so we don't know how to break into it. It should be boarded up, to be honest, but.
Can we not do that? Can't we board that house up?
Well, last week I got a received the phone call from the new owner, and he is adamant that it's secured. I said, we're getting conflicting answers here, that it's secured. I said, we hear that people are going in and leaving again. He said, I've got a video. He's taken a video of the front door. And I said, save those videos because we're going to need them because we have other evidence that people are going in and out. So I guess we'll have to talk to the attorney and see which way we're going to go now.
Ms. Sprinkle.
There's a cost to having a building like this with the number of
police visits coming or the fire department having to be deployed. And I think that's the frustration I run into is at what we, there's no dollar amount that we have at hand to say allowing this person to have that unsecured property or this nuisance property, I bet the citizens of the city would be furious. Like, this is, I have SWAT teams that show up. God knows what those things cost. So it's circular. I think it's just a real circular problem. I'd like to see if it takes 30, 40 years to get a house pulled down, I think that's a problem. And that's what we have.
Ms. Grunstead.
A couple of thoughts. First, kind of following up, June, on yours. And I've gotten at least a half dozen in the last month comments from people that they don't feel safe coming downtown. Part of it is because we've got a bunch of these vagrant houses. We've got people coming in. Part of it is because we've got a bunch of people with drug activities going on and miscellaneous other things downtown. I think we've got to address that, but I think this is part of it. A second one, one of my other projects that I work on, I'm on the Fairbanks Neighborhood Housing Services. Mr. Mayor and I are on that one. And we had a house similar to the one we're been discussing here out.
Boy, did we have a house.
Did we have a house. It's just past University West out there. And the bank finally took it back. Nobody wanted to touch it. There was a bunch of people living in there that shouldn't be there. Well, we finally, as an organization, we purchased the thing. Our mission is housing in Fairbanks area. And we took it. We took half a dozen 20 and 40 foot dumpsters worth of trash out of there. It was a disgusting place. We got the troopers. We went in with the troopers to get the people out. It took some work, but we went in and I don't know what we put, $50,000 or $70,000 worth into that thing. And now we've got a house ready on the market to make it a good house. The neighbors love us. That's what it does. It'll turn a neighborhood if you do a few of these. And I think we need to think about creatively, because most of these people aren't going to fix these houses, just the way it is. You know, so if we can find an organization, and maybe we need to talk with our other board and start looking at some of these. If it's a solid structure, which we may need some help from you folks, but maybe there's ways we could get different people to come in. If the neighbor across the street doesn't want to do this, I'm assuming this one over here on Fifth is a solid structure. I haven't looked at it in years, but maybe there's an opportunity to do stuff like that, working with other groups that are willing to come in and do the grunt work and get it back into a marketable house.
Ms. Sprinkle, just a thought here. If you could get that list into the city clerk, then I can take a look at it. And I can drive around with you and take a look at them as we give it to Clem. And then I can start doing reports on it, like this is what the status of it. So I can give a bi-monthly status report on each property. Maybe we take it to that level. And so everyone knows.
You know, if some of these folks who don't want to take care of it anymore, just a gentle prod to say, hey, sell the property.
Yeah. Clem's quite busy, and he has a staff vacancy. So my thought is someone like myself and you can take a look at these too, mm-hmm. because this is very important to me, and just start making a list and having twice monthly updates where we're at, what it's doing, so everyone can just start following it and tracking it. And that way we have action items on each property.
I would love to
let's
be part of that. Thank
okay,
you.
Okay, let's
yes.
me and you do that.
Thank you.
Of course, Ms. Rogers.
Sorry, John, you just pulled my chain. you and I have talked about these things before. I have a real problem with our citizenry in the valley, in the Tanawha Valley. I extend all around all the hills, and all of us who live here saying that they don't feel safe in downtown. I understand that they say that. I have a real problem with people who say it and repeat it and then gather groups who say it and who avoid downtown. And I see it. I know it's there. I am standing firm downtown, and many times I'm there very, very late at night and dark, and all of the things that people say is adding to the problems of such. And I have never, ever, ever felt that I was in distress by where I was at. Yesterday I encountered a situation over at the post office. So I was late coming over here to pick up a packet of things that I had said I would drop by and pick up because I called the service patrol. And it took a while for someone to get over there and help with the situation. I have been involved with other circumstances there at the post office also where the person who was laying on the floor was actually someone who was encountering a seizure. And everybody in our community walked away from that man. I was the only person who went over to him. Because when you have a seizure, your body fluids leave and so on and so forth, and it wasn't pleasant. We cannot decide to only participate in what's pleasant in our community. We have to be the family that I talk about incessantly over and over. And it doesn't matter what committee I'm talking about, whether it's bed tax or whether it's abatement properties or whether it's education or what it is. I think we are definitely a family in this community, and we need to more often remember that and take care of people in a caring way rather than decide who isn't worthy and who is. And I am over and over and over hearing those comments about how afraid everyone is. I am 5'1½", and I am not, and I'm also, I've got an artificial hip over here and another one that probably needs to be replaced. And the person at the post office yesterday, I probably could have broken my other hip trying to help them up. But I did. I got another person to help me with it. And I don't know. I find it really hard. And so the only reason you and I have talked about this, you know how I feel about all this. But I just don't want to ever, I've vowed that I won't ever hear that phrase without countering it in some way. So there we are. Thank you, cousin.
We're going to move on to the next item. Mr. Clutton, go ahead, Mr. Clutton.
So anyway, you have a list of about 20 properties other than these?
Oh, almost 50.
50?
Yeah.
Okay. But
you don't want to make the sprinkle list.
That's just a small little town. Yeah.
Yes, yeah. But it's not like it's, okay, 50, if we average 10 a year, that's 5 years. We could get more aggressive. I mean, I think it's, you know, we do have some older homes in town, but it's not the end. You know, Fairbanks is still a pretty decent town.
Oh, yeah, sure.
You know, so I think we can resolve it. Just a little more effort in the right direction.
Ms. Rogers.
I will make this really, really brief, but it's a very important statement. When there's any conversation about this at all, we need to remember that we wouldn't be as successful in handling these difficulties if it wasn't for Clem and mm-hmm. how he handles them. Thank you.
Thank you.
Okay. Thank you, Clem. We're going to go to item 2 now. Resolution to extend the sunset date of Ordinance 6227 as amended, which amended the CBA between the city and FFU IAFF Local 1324. And we'll go to Chief of Staff Mike Sanders on this.
Okay. So, at the last council session, when the LOA was passed, but the ordinance was amended, putting a sunset clause at the end of the year, I did not know that was in violation of the code. The way I saw it was that the city council is able to, you know, at every budget they're able to fund or not fund anything. That's why I was thinking that it wasn't a violation of the code, but. But afterwards, I learned that it was, in fact, a procedural violation, and that the way forward looked pretty complex, to be honest. So my suggestion to city clerk, city attorney, was that instead of going through the pretty complex way of getting it fixed, that we just put the resolution to make it to the end of the contract, so that we're not in violation of the not in a procedural violation. So that's how we got here.
Mr. Cleworth.
What code did we violate?
More to those guys.
Effectively, it was an unfair labor practice to do anything other than vote up or down the LOA. What we did was, or what the council did, was agreed to the language amending the CBA, but that language exists within the larger collective bargaining agreement. So unless the LOA specifically has a date other than what is in the CBA, we have to follow the CBA's dates. So it would be an unfair labor practice to do anything other than vote up or down on a contract amendment.
And this resolution
fixes it, because basically what we're doing is just putting the date to the end of the CBA, to the collective bargaining agreement.
So, Jerry, your amendment put us in labor violation. Oh, my goodness.
Well, I guess I don't quite see it that way, because you are amending a contract. There's an opportunity to amend a contract. By amending it the way we did, we made a counteroffer. We didn't accept the one that was on the floor. We made a counteroffer that can be accepted or rejected by the union, right?
No. What has to happen with any kind of offer, counteroffer, is that has to take place in the LOA and with the bargaining unit. Once the bargaining unit agrees with the mayor's signature and the union official's signature, and it's brought to the council, all the council can do at that point is say yes or no. They could say, we don't agree with this, send it back to the bargaining agreement or bargaining unit so that the bargaining unit can work out whatever disagreement they can have. But we can't amend it on the fly in this body. It has to be done there and then brought back to council, and then council can say yes or no.
And Mr. Saunders, does the union agree to this resolution?
Yes, they didn't have a problem with it.
Okay. Mr. Cleworth.
The reality is that you're not actually putting an end date to this. In the contract, you have an evergreen clause. If we come to impasse in labor negotiations, that contract exists in perpetuity until we come up with a successor to it. So you're not going to be ending this if we go to impasse on it. It's just going to become a part of that contract. If we go through mediation without resolution, we go to arbitration, and we do not accept the arbitrator's award, this thing becomes permanent in that contract until we have a successor agreement. Isn't that right?
Councilmember Cleworth is correct. So we extended it to September 30, 2024, because that's the current end date in the collective bargaining agreement. But Councilmember Cleworth is correct. If we reach an impasse in bargaining for the CBA and it moves forward, that date is static as opposed to the dynamic kind of end date. So if the body wanted to replace the September 30, 2024 with the end date in the CBA, I think that would also be acceptable. We just can't make it before that.
Yeah. I mean, the only reason I voted for this other night was as an experiment to see if it worked. I questioned the fiscal note. I hope that it's accurate. But when you increase a minimum staffing level to 13, especially when we have one shift with 13 people, and ultimately, on average, you're going to have several people that are not there. You're going to have overtime there that we do not currently have to incur if we don't have the budget for it, but now we do. And I don't know if we get into a forced overtime situation or not, which I really hate. I don't like to force people to do that sort of a thing. But it's going to have an economic impact that we will have a better picture of by the end of this year. that we're going to automatically extend it into next year as well. And I have a real problem with that. So if that is the case with this, then I would say let's just not do it. Wait for labor negotiations to start next year and pick up the issue at that time. But you're not, I just want to emphasize, you're not setting an end date here. If you go to impasse, it's becomes until you have some kind of a successor agreement, and that could be a year, 2 years from now, or whatever. Or you don't have one. You just come to impasse.
Ms. Tidwell.
I think it's important to recognize that we have to increase our staff over there. I mean, whether we need to increase our staff much more than just allowing them to cross staff, which is what the LOA does. I mean, we have a need in this community to have three ambulances going, and yes, there's going to be overtime if there's people missing, just like there is right now. The fact that this becomes part of the contract, I mean, this is what we need, and I think that we all agree that we have to have more services in our community as our community, like the call numbers show that. And even though I was confused kind of what happened with the date on during the meeting, but I do know that it's important that we stick to the decision that we made and show our community that we're supporting the need for the services that they require.
Mr. Cleworth.
Takes six people to run three ambulances. Right now, we have an artificial minimum staffing of 12, which leaves six other people. And in my opinion, that's enough. So to say that we are not covering it, I think is incorrect. We have the manpower, we have the paramedics, we've got the equipment to run six ambulances. It's just that we have a CBA that doesn't allow us to do it. And so I guess I would disagree saying that, and I know Mike disagrees with me and everybody, but I really have a problem with the way that we're staffing the equipment and the personnel and use of the personnel and the resources we have and doing the job. I heard the other night that this isn't 2019, that the world has changed. I don't buy that. I don't buy that it's changed that much. More calls, maybe. But our fire calls have been ever so slowly increasing, fairly stagnant, and that's a nationwide trend. We don't allow volunteers. 60-some percent of the firefighters in this country are volunteers. We don't allow that. And if we say, well, we need more and more and more, then why do we artificially limit ourselves to whom we can and can't have over there? Just, anyway, I think we've got the resources. I just think we're going backwards here from what we had a few years ago. So I would just speak against the resolution because I think it needs to be clear this is not going to be a deadline to become the impasse on this thing. The evergreen clause will supersede this. So.
Ms. Sprinkle.
So I'm confused as to whether or not this resolution we're looking at is not illegal. This is illegal. What we've done is illegal. I'm confused as to what this is doing.
Mr. Would you please go through it again, Mr. Chard?
Sure. So, Councilmember Sprinkle, the other night at the council meeting, there was a date recommended for the ordinance. The sunset date was December 31, 2023.
Okay.
That date is different than the end date of the collective bargaining
CBA.
Agreement,
okay.
Right, the CBA. That collective bargaining agreement is goes until September 30, 2024. So all we were pointing out is we can't make a date other than the end date of the CBA unless that is in the LOA, which it wasn't. So, but Councilmember Cleworth is correct. You know, we tried to solve this problem in the simplest way possible with this resolution in front of you by just simply extending the sunset date to the end date of the CBA. However, if we can't do a collective bargaining agreement and can't come to an agreement on the next round, that date wouldn't be a date certain. It would be extended because of an evergreen clause. So you know, this is a resolution on a procedural problem, kind of separate from the substantive discussion that's happening about staffing levels.
And where we made the mistake was adjusting the letter of agreement here in council meeting.
With the date.
Yeah. So, Mr. Chart, if we did a new letter of agreement with the December 31st, 2023, agreed with all parties and did a substitute resolution, that would take care of the issue.
Yes, that's correct.
Okay.
It'd have to be an ordinance, but that's correct.
Mr. Ringstead.
What happens if we do nothing?
So if you do nothing.
You have a CBA in place.
What'll happen is December 31, 2023 will come, and it'll be a trigger date for the authority that was granted in the ordinance Monday. And if the body does something that I think the union could object to, they could additionally object to, on procedural grounds, the unfair labor practice.
So they do that, well, the contract, current contract ends in a year, right? So they can object at that point. They object at that point. I mean, at that point, we're going to renegotiate. You can renegotiate whatever we want to renegotiate in the next contract.
Well, so if the union today wanted to object to the action that the council took, they could object on procedural grounds. If they wanted to wait until December 31st, 2023, when the trigger date for the ordinance happens and you guys decide to do whatever you do, they could object at that point on procedural grounds. It's just closing a liability or at risk there.
What's the end date of the current contract?
September 30, 2024.
Mr. Sanders.
The only thing that I'd put out there is, do any of us actually believe that in December that suddenly the call volume is going to go down and we're not going to need the three ambulances and two engines and a battalion chief? I mean, I realize that, yes, if we skip doing fire calls, if we skip having an engine going to help out when it's a code or any of those other things where you need more than just a driver and a medic, we'd be fine. If we basically, if we were to skip doing the services that we owe the community, we would be fine. But this is the package that we need to provide the services to the community. Anything less than that, I don't know how you make it work. If people were to schedule out their emergencies, like, hey, you're allowed to have a heart attack at 2 o'clock, you're allowed to have your motor vehicle accident at 3 o'clock, we can make it work. That's not how real life is. We need to have all those apparatuses manned. That's the way emergency services are.
Ms. Sprinkle?
So you mentioned going back to rewrite our LOA.
That's not our ordinance. Something that can be done, depending on if...
That could eliminate this?
Yes. You'd have to go back to the ordinance.
Okay.
To do that, to insert the date of December 31st, 2023, and have the union agree to it, and that removes... That gives you certainty on that you go into the next collective bargaining agreement, and that is not there. And that's what Jerry wants to see. He wants to have certainty that this is not extended in perpetuity when we can't agree with what they have in our next CBA agreement, because this is there and it's been inserted and it can't be removed unless both sides agree to it. That's what
that's correct.
Yeah.
And that's what we've done this to ourselves, right?
Yeah. Okay. So, yeah. So, we all, you know, I recognize the need for the increase of the department. But at the same time, I recognize the need to have certainty where this is an experiment. We've all said this is an experiment. There has to be an end date on the experiment. If it works, great. If it doesn't work. Mr. Cleworth.
Mr. Sanders, if we have 12 people on a shift and six are going to provide the three ambulances, that gives us six people. for engines. How many people does it take on an engine?
It takes three. Now, if you don't want to have a battalion chief, then you would be able to do it with 12.
Battalion chief could not drive his rig. He could be on an engine, essentially, right?
Have you seen what a battalion chief does during a fire? They are their command and control. The people in the engine are the ones that are fighting the fire. They're the ones that are, you know, they're going to all the different calls. The battalion chief will go on. They will go check out some calls too to see what is needed. It's not like they're just an excess.
But most fire. Of the time, we don't have all three ambulances involved when we have a fire call.
We don't have three ambulances.
It happens. But if we have, the other one is we also have automatic aid for fire. We don't have that with ambulance. We have mutual aid, which we burn out because we rely on them too much. But in 2019, we got rid of that problem by running three ambulances.
Mr. Chard.
Just to put this out there, this resolution is very, very focused on a procedural problem that happened on Monday. I understand that it invokes the substantive debate that we had on Monday about staffing and ordinance and community need and all that. And honestly, that's a political decision up to you guys. All I'm trying to do with this ordinance is say, procedurally, we either need to make the end date of the contract or, as the mayor suggested, go back to the drawing board with the LOA, with the bargaining team. But there's a procedural issue that I think needs to be corrected, aside from the important substantive discussion that you guys are having right now.
Ms. Brinkle, then Mr. Ringstead.
So we either agree with this, extend the date, and keep it moving forward, or you're saying we have to go back and relitigate or reopen this discussion with the union, and that sounds a lot more sloppy and maybe painful. That's the options I'm hearing. Is that correct?
Well, they agreed to the 31st of December anyway, prior. It was discussed. Only we went about it wrong.
It sounds like we got it wrong, right?
Procedurally, yes, we
did. Okay, so I just want to make sure that we don't go backwards. That's all I want to make sure of.
I understand that. Mr. Ringstead.
So, if we pass this resolution, I think one of the concerns is that then we're stuck with it forever. Okay, if we pass this resolution, we're saying the sunset date is just 9 months later. What happens at 9 months? Does this thing just go away?
Well,
it sunsets, today is over.
As I reported to council before, every month, and it's about that time where Margarita gives me the operating costs of the departments, and I'm always looking at police, fire, and public works. And I can tell you the amounts of overtime that each one is giving, and so the next 9 months we're going to see in this experiment, or whatever it is through the collective bargaining agreement, you're going to have a monthly report of if it's working or not. From me, because I look at it every month.
What's the legal ramification?
Does the union then have to agree that it stops? Or is it just, it stops unless we take action?
Mr. Chard.
So, Councilmember Ringstead, essentially what happened the other day when you approved the LOA was that you amended the larger collective bargaining agreement. So the ordinance and the change to staffing became part of the collective bargaining agreement. On September 30, 2024, that's the end date for the collective bargaining agreement. So you would enter a new round of negotiation with the firefighters union, and this cross-staffing concept would be part of that, you know, overall negotiation about what to do with the CBA. So if at that point your negotiating team wanted to continue on that experiment, if at that point you guys had a different direction you wanted to go or decided not to do this anymore, I mean, it would be part of the larger discussion of what happened with the CBA.
So until such time as we come to an agreement, though, this stays in place, and I think that's the evergreen, clause. So, I mean, theoretically, you could say, well, we never come to an agreement, then that, and then this stays in place forever.
That is correct. Ms. Sprinkle.
But that's with regards to the cross-platforming, and it would just stay that way.
That is correct.
Okay. I'm happy with that. Okay.
Any other questions on this unique subject? Ms. Tidwell.
I just wanted to say for the record, I've heard a couple times it be said that this is an experiment and we just want to try it. Like, it's not an experiment. This is the language that the chief came up and has been negotiated in the firefighters union. It's a concession for the union to allow the cross-staffing. It's what our chief has said he needs to run the department. We can't go back in time. Like, we have to at some point go forward. And, you know, I have never seen this as an experiment that we should try. Like, this is what we need. We need even beyond this. This is a step in the right direction.
Okay. Ms. Rogers.
I want to follow that with one of the comments that Mr. Cleworth made about volunteers. I hear that occasionally, and I see where it's never been a positive discussion or got any, you know, momentum. But it's still something that is happening across the nation in various ways of success. And I think if we are meeting difficulties in our community with staffing, it's our obligation to discuss that. So I think I just at some point in the future, we should probably bring it up, and I'm not sure, you know, what our agreements have to say about that. I know that a lot of people do not give proper regard to volunteers. I myself have worked with volunteers for the last 45 years, and I've given workshops at statewide conferences about volunteers and volunteer recruitments, and it's amazing to me how many people downgrade the ability of a volunteer because, quote, they're not paid. And I maintain and have put in my workshops about this that everyone is paid when you're all working together on a job. Some are paid differently than others. And so it's your obligation as an organization or a company or a nonprofit or whatever institution to interview and understand the people that you employ in the work of project to see what kind of payment they require and what kind of payment they deserve. And it's a very different, if I go work on a project, I'm not looking for a paycheck. But I do have some things I would like to see happen and change in the community on behalf of something. And so there is a bargaining chip there as far as that goes. So I think that we need to look at those as an asset in our those concepts as an asset in our community, and we need to explore them.
Mr. Ringstead.
I would like, I guess, request, Mike, if you could run this down. I don't know how we have this information. But in our calls between our fire and our ambulance, and figure out how do we, what the really specific needs are, what of our ambulance calls, how many of them are not true emergencies? We're just moving somebody from the hospital to the Pioneer Home or wherever they're going, and kind of get a better breakdown of what these emergency calls are and what percent, what, you know, what by kind of percentage of calls. Likewise with our fire department, you know, we've heard several times that we're averaging 7 minutes a day for the platform truck. Well, that doesn't really give me any picture of 7 minutes a day. If I do the next step in the math, I'm saying it goes out about once a week. You know, tell me really how often are we moving, how long, if okay, we have all these fire calls. What's the average time these fires are, the equipment is out there? And how many rigs, I mean, do you send all the rigs on every call? You know, so we get some ideas to, I think kind of where Jerry was going is how many of these people are out? One call doesn't mean everybody goes, or does it? I don't know. You know, so can you get a better breakdown from over there as to what, to how that, the numbers work that way?
Mr. Sanders?
Definitely. And before you were on council, we did that over and over and over again last year. We had work sessions, and we had, I don't know how many times it came up. But we can do it again. We can go over it again. I think the best thing to do is, the other day, four council members, all the council members minus Mr. Cleworth and Ms. Rogers went through the HIPAA training. My suggestion is go over there for a few hours and see it for yourself. That's really how you would you could actually see what's going on, and it won't be any of this, hey, back in 1982 it was done this way and we need to be able to do it. It'd be like the legitimate, hey, these are the calls that these folks are going on. This is why you need more than just a medic and a driver for somebody who's in cardiac arrest or somebody who's having a stroke or, any of those types of calls.
Ms. Sprinkle.
Oh, sorry. I just have one other thing that I would like to throw out there. Another thing that this LOA does that I didn't even think of until I was talking to Mr. Clark, Nick Clark from the union, is it – right now, anything the CBA says that anytime that we are above minimum manning, that they're allowed to have three people on leave. Well, with this bringing the minimum manning up to 13, it drops them down to just two people on leave. So there is that too. It helps out with that.
Ms. Sprinkle,
I just want to remember we're talking about this, right? We're not trying to renegotiate a contract today.
We have a resolution in front of us,
and
yes.
I just want to focus us on that because we need people to run the safety apparatus, the EMTs. I don't want to go backwards, but I'd like to at least make sure that we aren't breaking the law or the spirit of the contract. And that's
why you have the resolution,
right? So that I just wanted to focus us back, and okay. And I think that the chief gave us some paperwork about, is it UHUs? The talk about how many hours of a piece of apparatus is used?
Yes, unit hour utilization.
And I bet I could share that with you because I think we have that. Thanks.
Okay, we're going to move on to item four, our first ever Finance Committee report from Margarita Bell.
Good morning, everyone. You have before you just a recap of our first using the new format, our first Finance Committee meeting, which was April the 13th. And I just wanted to let you know that we are starting the discussion on the tobacco excise tax. That was a task that you addressed to the Finance Committee. So they've started the discussion on that. And that we are looking at the capital fund as another project that we're starting to address, just making sure that in the future we have sufficient funds for our equipment needs as we move forward. And you can read that. Our next meeting is May the 11th at 7 a.m. in the Felix Pedro conference room.
Council members, do you have any questions for Ms. Bell? Ms. Bell, do you have anything in conclusion?
And you'll notice that you have a quarterly budget overview report as of March 31, 2023. And you'll see that we are at 14.3% revenue. I did, in the discussion section, mention some of the areas that are high and low versus our target of 25%. You'll see that taxes appears to be lower, but we have sale taxes as of February. Our charges for services are over the 25% target. That's primarily due to ambulance revenues. Intergovernmental will see revenue for that usually in July and August. Majority of those funds are coming from the state. The licenses and permits, we're over our target significantly, and that's due to our building permits. So fines and forfeiture, we're usually below target until we have the garnishments, permanent fund dividend garnishments. Interest and penalties, you're seeing the increase is due to interest rates, and that will definitely need an adjustment. And that was an item that we kind of adjusted in a budget, but we didn't fill. And I remember Mr. Clewer stating we should go higher on that. So you'll see that in the first budget amendment. Rental and leases, a big portion of that is our utilidor that's not billed until August. And the other revenues, there's a $200,000 Techite payment that we receive that's usually made in July. And the other sources, the reason for that difference that you're seeing there is we do not do the permanent fund dividend transfer until December. And it appears to will be on target for that as well. And that's an overview on your revenue. If you flip your page over, or I believe it's front and back. On the expenditure side, you'll see that we're at 24% with a target of 25%. A majority of our departments are under that section. IT would be your first one over 25%, and that's because the majority of our annual contracts are paid in January. That's the reason for that difference. I just want to call to your attention that the fire overtime is at 29% of budget. Last year, the department was at $484,000. This year, they are at $259,000. It's a big difference. I know there was a question regarding the fiscal note. I do want to kind of mention, when we're talking about the fiscal note for that contract, most of your overtime is happening on your, what I call the top three, your BC, your captain, and your drivers. And so I still think that that piece needs to be addressed. You did increase the budget for overtime for this year, so you are looking at a decrease of 46% from the prior year in cost. So just wanted to let you be aware of that, and that is why your fiscal note is written the way that it is. Public Works temporary budget is at 58%. Last year, this is a 20% decrease from the prior year of their expenditures. And engineering, I'll have to do a budget amendment for them. You'll see that they are over budget, and that is due to city projects. So you will see adjustment for that. So any questions on revenues and expenditures? And that's your quarterly report.
You mentioned that Joshua Church requested to report in thousands versus millions for the cash flow report.
Yes. The report that they were reviewing, the committee reviews or will be reviewing a monthly cash flow statement, and the report that they had before them was in millions, and so he requested that we do it in thousands. So that's what that statement was for. And so we have $31.2 million, so instead of showing $31.2 million, we'll show $312,000, if that makes sense. He felt that it would show more information than what the report had, that they had presented.
Okay.
By doing thousands versus millions.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. So basically, in review of expenses by department, Mr. Chard's department is doing more with less. Good job, sir.
Aren't we all?
You're starting out right. Yeah. Are any other questions for Margarita on this? Seeing none, we'll go to mayor and council member comments. We'll start with Ms. Rogers.
Oh, I already took up way too much time this morning. Thank you.
Ms. Sprinkle.
I appreciate you allowing me to talk about the abatement in our community, because it's just one of those things that I know isn't going to go away, and I appreciate the time you'll allow me to spend with you chasing mm-hmm. that. Thank you.
Mr. Clayworth.
The state of Alaska had a new bill filed to have a state sales tax, which is a very complicated thing. The state of Alaska, by law, does not allow municipalities to have income taxes. They usually use sales taxes if they want them. We have four different sales taxes plus an excise tax that we use. If the state of Alaska comes along on the municipalities, especially like the city of North Pole, and institutes a sales tax, their exemptions are not going to be the same as North Poles would be, or Kenai, or any of the other Juneau, or any of the other municipalities that institute a general sales tax. It's a nightmare. And how they plan on dealing with that, I have no idea, unless they're going to say that their law would supersede the municipalities. Is this something I feel strongly about, to send some kind of a resolution that we are opposed to a statewide general sales tax? If they want to, if they have to have a tax, then they should utilize the one that they reserve for themselves, which would be simpler to implement than by far than a state sales tax, which requires heavy auditing. If that's something that people think we should weigh in, I don't think this has a chance of going anywhere this legislative session, but I think it is a resolution we should maybe send to them, if you folks feel strongly about it too. So I'll just throw that out there.
Ms. Rogers?
Yes. John, comment on this, especially since your vast years of working with such and being on our legislative committee.
Mr. Rungstedt, we'll go to you now.
Oh, thank you, Mr. Mayor. You know, the state sales tax has been brought up numerous times over the last 40-some years I've been watching it. And kind of the thought has consistently come back to sales taxes for local governments. And that's kind of been the resolution to those issues. It's clumsy to monitor and run from a statewide perspective. Like Jerry says, it's hard. I think a lot of times, you know, if you've already got a sales tax in place on the local level, well, then they're just clipping the money and you're doing the work, really. I think the state has more options for revenues than the local governments. And I agree with Jerry that this is something that the local governments ought to stand up and say, hey, you know, why don't you leave that one alone? The truth of the matter is we have a lot of new faces in Juneau, and not just new in Juneau, but relative to this group and several others, new to Alaska and what have you. Not that that's a bad thing, but they don't have the institutional memory on these kind of issues. And I think it would be wise. Jerry's right. It's not going to happen in the next 30 days. But that's not to say they're not going to work on it all interim and be ready to come back next January and work on this. I don't know what Municipal League is doing about it. They ought to be doing something. But I think that we ought to be sending the message also that, you know, this shouldn't be the first tax out of the chute for the state. The state's revenue, the state's revenue is a funny thing. I mean, they need money. Well, last year they got a revenue forecast, said we're going to be at $111 a barrel and we're going to have lots of money, so they start spending. This year they come in and say we're going to be at $71 a barrel and we can't spend any money because we don't have any money. Well, some of us that have watched oil revenue for the last 50 years could tell you that it's not going to be this and it's not going to be that. So get over yourself. So I think that their revenue forecasting is at best a crapshoot. Years ago they were asked one time, how accurate are you? They're never within a 20% window. Year to year, they don't know. So to run out and do a sales tax and stick us with the problems with that, to me, is inappropriate, but we should say something.
Any other comments, Mr. Ringstead? Mr. Marney?
Well, I think they gave themselves raises, didn't they? Well, just good conversation on abatements. It's a problem. It's not going to go away, and I think we need to at least assign somebody in one department that just keeps tabs on it and manages it, because it's growing and growing and growing. So thank you.
Ms. Tidwell?
I would just say thanks to Jerry for bringing that up. And I do think it's something we should put a resolution together also. I'd be happy to co-sponsor that.
Write something up real quick for the Monday night.
Okay.
It'll be very simple.
Okay. My comments, I'd like to thank everyone for being here early and staying a little bit late. And Ms. Sprinkle, please get that list to the city clerk so me and you can, it can be distributed, and me and you can take a look at it and start this forming a plan of action. You know, 50 properties is 50 properties. They're not going anywhere. They're going to be there. So we can start prioritizing and taking a look at it. And I'm a real estate broker, and I do research, and we can give the city council a pretty good review of each property and how it looks. And we start there, and we keep going. Next regular work session will be Tuesday, May 2nd, 2023. Move to adjourn. Anyone opposed? We're adjourned.